only human, can you see? I made a mistake. Please just look me in my face. Tell me everything's okay. Cause I got it. Ooh, never be like you.
Hello there everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the MEL 2.0 series of AMPIL, the Australian Medical Students Association's podcast. My name is Daryl Goh and I will be your host for today's episode, Fighting Back, with our special guests, Janet Lowndes and Kieran Kennedy. Janet Lowndes is the Director and Principal Psychologist at Mind Body Well, a private clinic in Melbourne, providing outpatient therapies for people with eating disorders and concerns about weight and well-being. She has over 25 years experience in therapeutic practice, inspired by neuropsychotherapy, embodiment and social justice perspectives, which empower those seeking treatment and aim to address systemic inequalities and barriers to care. Janet is also an experienced trainer and supervisor, providing professional support to many professionals working in the eating disorder field. Kieran Kennedy is a registrar from Melbourne, working and training in psychiatry, with a passion for breaking down barriers and advocating for health of body and mind combined. He's a passionate proponent for the place modern doctors can have in the healthy influence of our communities. Alongside his medical work, he has moved outside the traditional medical box through speaking, writing, and media advocacy. He has been published in prominent health and fitness magazines and on online platforms, and appears on television as well. Before we begin, I would also like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we record this podcast, here in what is now known as Australia. I extend my respects to elders of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, past, present and emerging. AMSA acknowledges that sovereignty of this land has never been ceded, and this land always was and always will be Aboriginal land. I do just want to warn people that what we're talking about today may be touchy for some people, so please do look out for yourself, especially if eating disorders are something that has impacted your life. So eating disorders are something that we hear about quite often, and they are very much at the intersection of various aspects of society, from health in the medical field to our culture and trends around appearance, fitness, and body ideals. But they can also be terribly debilitating conditions that isolate people with them in shame and secrecy. So join me and our guests as we bite back and talk about what all medical students should know about eating disorders, and how we can shape our culture and communities to have a healthier relationship with food and eating. Janet, Kieran, thanks so much for being here today.
No worries.
Daryl, thank you. It's a pleasure. Thanks for the invitation to be here.
Start off, just to give our listeners an idea of where we're coming from, why don't you tell us what you do in your work and why eating disorders are such an important issue for you?
Sure. So I am a psychologist. I'm the principal psychologist and director of a practice in Melbourne called Mind Body Well. And we're a very focused eating disorder clinic. We're a private clinic of both psychologists and dietitians. And we work predominantly with people with eating disorders and disordered eating and food issues really right across the weight spectrum. So that means we're really keen on working with people with all kinds of different presentations of eating issues, and that we're very inclusive in the treatment services that we provide. And I guess I've been a psychologist now for 28 years, and I came to eating disorders very early in my career because I was working a lot with adolescents, and I just started actually learning from my clients, from working with a lot of young people, that issues with food and eating and body image were very common and were very significant issues of distress for a lot of the young people I was working with. So I started learning from my clients along the way and then became very interested in eating disorders and kind of grew from there. And I've been working in the field, yeah, for probably at least 25 of those 28 years.
I am a senior psychiatry registrar in Melbourne at the moment, so I am about 6 months shy of popping out the end as a consultant, so we're nearly there. And obviously within that, for the last 5 years, I've been doing the Psych Ridge roller coaster of the training scheme. So that's had me working in child and adolescent mental health, adult inpatient, and all the other areas. But my work at the moment is subspecializing in consult liaison psychiatry. So that's mental health on the medical and surgical wards, in the emergency department, in the ICU. So when it comes to talking about eating disorders, this is something that I see quite a lot in my work with CL psychiatry. Obviously, if someone with an eating disorder is at the point with their physical health where they need to be admitted to a medical ward, for example, then the CL psychiatry team will get involved with supporting the patient and the medical team with that. So eating disorders are something that I see a fair bit of in my work. And as with every psych registrar, it's part of our training to become a psychiatrist as well, as learning about this really, really important group of mental health disorders. And I mean, you asked there why this is something that I think is important for us to talk about. And we could probably have a whole podcast just on that alone. But, you know, eating disorders are a set of mental health struggles for people that are actually increasing. And so it's something that we really need to start thinking about and talking about more, especially as doctors, no matter what specialty you're going to go into. And they're also really important because a lot of the eating disorders have a significant impact on people's health and their functioning. And anorexia, for example, is one of the highest mortality and morbidity rate disorders within psychiatry. So these are really quite serious, significant conditions. And that's why I think it's really important that we're having a chat about them today. So thanks for having me on to ramble about them.
All right, to start off, why don't we take it back to the basics? What is disordered eating and what is an eating disorder?
So I think of eating behaviours on a continuum, and at one end of the continuum might be a person who has a totally uncomplicated relationship with food and with their eating behaviours and with their body. Realistically, I think in modern culture, that's actually quite rare. So for someone to have what I think of as total food freedom and really healthy body image and a comfortable relationship with food and with eating in the culture that we live in is actually not a common situation, very sadly. So if that's at one end of the continuum of that food freedom and flexibility and a very relaxed attitude to food and eating and a natural kind of focus on moderation and balance, and then if we move further along the continuum, I'd see disordered eating somewhere along the way. And disordered eating is really about when people start to deliberately change their eating behaviors with often a growing amount of distress and discomfort and challenge that's coming with changing those eating behaviors. And then as we move further along from disordered eating to an eating disorder, that's when we start talking about the more clinically diagnosed conditions that really are recognized as mental health conditions and also as being very considerably challenging on a physiological, social, psychological, relational, all sorts of levels that eating disorders can impact on a person's life. So I don't see eating disorders as a black and white issue. I think it's more about where people are on the continuum. And certainly there are very severe episodes or situations where we can see an easily identified clinical eating disorder. But I'd also say it's important that we're paying attention to the whole continuum, especially from disordered eating, disturbed body image, up to eating disorder.
And that's a really, really good place to start, because it can be a little bit confusing. And I think we'll get into a bit more of this chat as we go. But, you know, we're living in a world now where there is a lot about fitness and body image and diet culture and all these different things. So trying to pick apart what exactly we're talking about when we're talking about an eating disorder is a really important first step. And I guess if we strip it right down to the basics in terms of diagnosis and the DSM, for example, an eating disorder is a condition where feeding and eating, or some aspect of intake of food or input and output of energy from a food-based perspective, is significantly disrupted to the point where someone's health and or their functioning is significantly disturbed. And those two last points are kind of one of the keys that we kind of hold sacred in most of our psychiatry diagnoses. So if some form of thinking, feeling, or behavior is getting to a point where it's impacting significantly on someone's health and or their ability to go through their day-to-day life in terms of their functioning, whether that be at work, in their social lives, at home, with their family, then if it's starting to affect those things, that's when it starts to come to the point of being labeled as a disorder or an illness, and where someone really might need a helping hand there. So technically, these are a group of disorders of feeding and or eating. And in the DSM-5, for example, that's the broad category that these disorders fall under, feeding and eating disorders. And so the base point number one, as we've said, is that it involves some significant disruption of eating behavior. And also, but not always, there's an element of an attachment to that coming from a place of body image or weight. So, for example, bulimia nervosa or anorexia nervosa need to have a significant connection to eating behaviors influenced by someone's perception of themselves in terms of their body image or their weight. An eating disorder is first and foremost around eating behavior, but there's often these sort of really complex, tricky kind of pushes and pulls when it comes to weight and body image as well. And there are a small but very important group of disorders within this category. So we're obviously talking about the big ticket items, which I think most medical students and most people will be very familiar with, or hopefully familiar with, which are anorexia and bulimia, the common ones that we see and we talk about, especially in medicine. But we've also got some slightly less known eating disorders as well. So we've got pica, which is a disorder where an individual eats non-nutritive substances. So these are significantly and frequently eating things that are not traditionally food. So it might be eating paper or soil or hair. And this is a relatively rare condition, but it's included as an eating disorder. We've now got binge eating disorder, which is becoming increasingly more common. And that's where an individual has binge eating episodes without vomiting or compensating for that intake. And then we've got a big category of other feeding and eating disorders. And this can include everything from atypical anorexia to purging disorder, where someone just purges without binging. So basically, this is a category of disorders within psychiatry that includes quite a large range of different types of behaviors and struggles when it comes to eating and body image as well. Yeah, they're a big part of our psychiatry training and a big bit of learning for our exam.
Thanks for that quick introduction. And since most of our listeners will probably work in fields that are not directly concerned with eating disorders, how can they identify when a patient under their care may be experiencing an eating disorder? And is there anything they should take note of in caring for that patient?
Yeah, that's a really good point, because as you say, I will, until the cows come home, push for all the medical students listening here to become psychiatrists. So hopefully people are interested in psychiatry. But you're right, statistically, most medical students obviously won't become psychiatrists. We'll spread ourselves out into other specialties and areas, which is great. But the thing with mental health and psychiatry as a whole is that it's really, really important to be learning about this and keeping it in mind, whatever specialty you're passionate about and planning to go into, because all doctors will be seeing mental illnesses and mental health outcomes in some form. And that's the same with eating disorders. So if you're set on becoming a GP, obviously managing patients with eating disorders is going to be an important part of your work. If you're in general medicine, gastro, you'll have patients being admitted to the hospital, as we said earlier on, for refeeding, for electrolyte disturbances, for dehydration. And then even surgeons and other areas will often need to get involved potentially with treatment for these patients, or will come across patients with potentially disordered eating behaviors who are there for a completely unrelated reason. So I really like that question in terms of why is this important, but how do we also pick it up and maybe what do we do about it? So it's not always easy to identify someone who might have disordered eating behavior or an eating disorder. And something that's quite inherent to a lot of the disorders of eating is a secrecy around it, and a patient often being obviously a bit reluctant to disclose that. So I think if it's in a setting outside of mental health, it may be that this is actually quite difficult to pick up. But I think a way for the doctors in other areas of medicine to be picking up these things would be when there's some clear behaviors or thoughts and feelings expressed from their patient around food or around body image or weight that appear to be significantly impacting their health or their functioning. Obviously, the most clear ways that we might pick that up are physical issues with health coming from an eating disorder. And that might be a patient presenting with dehydration, potassium, magnesium, and phosphate disturbance for an unknown reason, a significantly low body weight. And that would lead to a suspicion that there may be an eating disorder present after we rule out any physical causes for potential unknown weight loss. So there were some really important and often fairly obvious signs and symptoms that can point doctors towards wondering whether some disordered eating behavior or an eating disorder might be part of the picture here. Other little signs and symptoms may be a patient becoming quite anxious or distressed around discussions to do with food or weight and body image. And part of my work in the hospital as a CL psychiatry registrar might actually be medical teams or surgical teams, for example, noticing that patients are very restrictive in their intake for meals within the hospital, or there might be signs or signals that a patient may be purging or engaging in compensatory behaviors such as vomiting after meals. So I think in terms of ways that doctors can pick up when an eating disorder might be present, it's a bit of a collection of what we observe clinically in the patient, what they're telling us in terms of their diets, how they feel about that and themselves and the anxiety and distress around it. But also eating disorders often present, if they're at a significant enough level, with some clear physical parameters and signs. And I think if there's ever any doubt, obviously these can be really tricky disorders to pick up sometimes and to also know kind of how to manage too. So I think contacting a mental health team or the psychiatry team would obviously be the way to go if you have significant concerns. But I think it's also around doctors and other specialties not feeling afraid to ask the question about these things as well. With eating disorders and struggles with body image and weight, there is often a lot of shame and guilt and secrecy involved. And so actually patients often describe in a way feeling quite relieved and thankful when the question is asked. So I think understandably, if you're not working in mental health or that's maybe not your passion, it can be a little bit anxiety provoking to know how to approach these topics. But I think if doctors and other specialties can just be starting that process by asking the question, it is really important. So asking about significant concerns around body image and weight, or asking around maybe a daily level of intake of food and fluid for a patient to start to get a little bit of a picture around A, what patient is taking in when it comes to food and fluid, but also how food and the relationship that a patient has with that is affecting their health and their day-to-day functioning as well. But like we said before, these conditions can come in a whole lot of different flavors. So there can be restriction of food intake, binge purging cycles, just binging, just purging, and sort of everything else in between. So I think the take-home message would be if you're picking up a significant suspicion or evidence that some part of intake of food and fluid is a little outside the normal realm, and most importantly, if it's impacting someone's physical and mental health significantly or their ability to function in their day-to-day life, then that would be when we'd think that a specialist might need to get involved. And that's when obviously we'd always be encouraging doctors and students from any aspect of medicine to be reaching out for more help and advice.
That's really interesting because I would say all doctors are working with a large number of people with eating disorders, whether they are aware of that or not. The statistics are very significant in terms of the numbers of people who are experiencing an eating disorder. The most recent statistics from the Butterfly Foundation say that 4% of the population at any given time are experiencing an eating disorder. And they also say that approximately 20% of females have an undiagnosed eating disorder. So the numbers are very significant. So I would actually really encourage everybody who's listening and all doctors to really get some specific training in eating disorders, because we know that eating disorders are under-recognized, under-reported largely from a lot of people who might attend to a doctor who may not identify themselves that what they're experiencing is an eating disorder. But we also know that eating disorders often come with a lot of shame and secrecy. So I think it's really important that doctors are well-trained in some of the kind of screening questions to ask and some of the things to be on the lookout for to help them identify eating disorders within their patient population. There are some excellent training programs for doctors that I really recommend through the NEDC, which is the National Eating Disorders Collaboration, and also the Inside Out Institute. They're two of the organizations in Australia that are offering really excellent foundational training for doctors in recognizing and responding to eating disorders. So I think that's the first thing I'd say, is that all doctors will be working with a very significant number of people with eating disorders, whether they're in a specialty eating disorder clinic or not. And I know one of the messages of the peak bodies in the eating disorder field in Australia at this point in time, which I really agree with, is that we need to be making eating disorders core business for all health professionals, which means that we need to increase the awareness and ability to respond right across the board for health professionals in the same way that has been done with depression, anxiety, with other common mental health conditions. That increasing mental health literacy really needs to include eating disorders because of the prominence of these conditions. And also, I think it's really important to recognize that there are multiple different types of eating disorders. When people think eating disorder, they often think low weight, restrictive eating, anorexia nervosa. But in reality, that's actually the least common presentation or diagnosis in Australia of an eating disorder. The most common diagnostic group is people with binge eating disorder, followed by bulimia nervosa and then anorexia nervosa. So it's really important for doctors to have a good foundational knowledge of the different types of presentations of eating disorders. And so I think those specialty training programs I would really recommend as a good foundation. It's also important, given we know that binge eating disorder is the most common eating disorder in Australia, that doctors are aware of that and cautious about the way they respond to people who might be at higher weights, people in larger bodies, because there's a lot of focus in the medical system at this point in time on weight reduction. But in many circumstances, what isn't being recognized is that to focus on weight alone can often send really unhelpful messages to people and can drive them towards unhealthy behaviors. And we know that a preoccupation with weight and shape and dieting behaviors are two of the biggest risk factors for the development of an eating disorder. So it's really important, I think, for doctors to have education that helps them focus on health behaviors rather than on weight, just as a standalone focus or priority. Let me share with you some of the questions that are recommended. And these are from one of the documents from the NEDC, the National Eating Disorders Collaboration. And this is a document for doctors in primary care. And they have these eating disorder screening questions. And I'll just mention a few of these. So these kind of questions can be really useful. The first one says, are you satisfied with your eating patterns? Really interesting, because that's such a different shift to saying, what do you weigh? So firstly, are you satisfied with your eating patterns? The next one is, do you ever eat in secret? So that's a really interesting question, because there's so much of the shame and secrecy, especially with binge eating disorder. And as I mentioned, 47% of people with a diagnosed eating disorder in Australia have binge eating disorder. So almost half. So it's really important that doctors are recognizing and screening for binge eating disorder. So that question about, do you ever eat in secret? The reality is most people who binge eat in secret. And that's quite different. You know, it's not a binge to eat a second slice of pizza or a third slice of pizza. Binging is usually the behavior that's done in secret. It's very excessive, and there's a lot of shame and secrecy connected with that. So that's a really important question. The next question is also a really good one, I think. Does your weight affect the way you feel about yourself? So again, not just what do you weigh, but does your weight affect the way you feel about yourself? Have any members of your family suffered from an eating disorder? We know now from a lot of the genetic studies that actually there is a very significant genetic predisposition towards eating disorders, especially that's been very strongly identified for anorexia nervosa. And also the research is continuing, but it's most likely that there's also genetic predisposition factors for all the eating disorders. And there's also, of course, the nature versus nurture issue about we learn a lot of our relationship with food and eating early on from our parents. So that's a really important question as well. And even just a straight up question, I think the term eating disorder is a really important term to actually use. So do you suffer or have you ever had an eating disorder in the past? So especially when working with adult clients, to actually ask that question, because sometimes people have had maybe an earlier experience of an eating disorder that may be on the rise again. Some other recent research shows that the highest new diagnostic group at the moment are perimenopausal women. When you think of the two biggest body changes in a woman's life, it's puberty and menopause. And so the perimenopausal change time, when it's quite natural for women's body weight to increase, for the shape of their body to change, that's another time, especially for people who've had eating disorders earlier, they're often resurfacing again at that time. So that's a really important thing also to be aware of. So those kinds of questions, and there are more questions in that document that are worth having a look at, and people can find them fairly easily on those websites. So yeah, I think those kinds of questions that are really directly opening the conversation around eating behaviors and preoccupation with weight, and they're so much broader than just focusing on numbers of kilograms, for example.
I think one of the take-home messages for students and doctors working in other areas might be around some of the really significant physical impacts that eating disorders can have, particularly when they reach a certain level. I think knowing some of those features and making sure that you studied up on those aspects is really, really important and can be really helpful, not just for the patient, but for us in the psychiatry world as well. Because if mental health is getting involved, we're going to be relying on you guys or our other colleagues to help us make sure that someone is physically stable and okay for the mental health side of their treatment to progress and for the patient to move forward. So for example, when it comes to anorexia nervosa, we know that when a patient is significantly low in their body weight, or for any eating disorders, if they have electrolyte disturbances and different physical issues going on, that can impact on their ability to process things cognitively. It can make patients slightly more rigid in terms of their thinking and cognition because the brain and body are in a starvation state, and or changes in electrolytes and nutrition are actually subtly impacting our brain and our thinking as well. So it's really, really important, I think, for medical students and doctors in other areas to be noting down what the physical signs and potential symptoms of an eating disorder might be, so that they can ensure that the patient is A, physically safe acutely, but also work with the psychiatrists and the mental health team from a mind-body perspective, make sure that we're treating this patient and helping them move forward from both the mental health side and the physical side. So we've touched on some of those already, but I think it is knowing what can happen to the body with significant restriction in food or deficits in nutritional intake. And so electrolyte disturbances are one of the most serious things with eating disorders. And these are really important because they can start to have impacts on cardiac function and other aspects of the body if they're significantly deranged from normal. So changes in pulse, blood pressure, even arrhythmia are quite significant risks if someone with an eating disorder has a severe disturbance in their electrolytes. So if someone has a known or a suspected eating disorder, making sure that we check basic obs, electrolytes, that we also check the things like full blood count, because long-term deficiencies in nutrition can impact a whole range of things like our white blood cells, our red blood cells, everything else in between. So making sure that those are stable and corrected is first and foremost. Then other aspects can move forward from there. So obviously nutritional intake and refeeding is something in the inpatient setting that someone might need assistance with, and that is ideally done through dietitian input and nutritionists being involved to set out a meal plan for a patient, and for that to often be observed in the hospital so that someone can slowly start to put weight back on or correct electrolyte imbalances. But at times it may need to get to the point where someone needs enteral feeding as well. So sometimes we have to consider things like NG tubes to make sure that a patient's immediate physical safety is stabilized if their weight is significantly low or their nutritional intake is severely restricted. So I think one of the key things for doctors or medical students working in other areas or wanting to go into other areas to keep in mind is that eating disorders are very important for every type of doctor to know about, because it's not just something that is restricted to the mental health side of things. They can obviously have some very, very significant impacts on physical health as well. So this is something that we all need to be schooled up in, and you need to be aware of some of the signs and potential physical outcomes, regardless of what area of medicine you're working in.
I see. Yeah, we might change tracks a little. We've heard this word orthorexia being thrown about in recent days. I understand that it hasn't actually been classified as a diagnosable condition yet. But tell us what you think about that.
Yeah, that's a really interesting topic, I think. And you're right, orthorexia is not part of the DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. It's not at this point in time. There are some groups that are lobbying to have it included in the future. It's very interesting to look at what's happening in our culture in terms of this extreme focus on weight loss in many areas, because what can happen when people get very focused on weight and again, focusing on weight instead of health, is that they can become very obsessive and perfectionistic in their eating behaviors and their expectations around their diet. So orthorexia really is a term that's used when someone has a very obsessive, perfectionistic attitude towards their eating behaviors. And it's an interesting area to be recognized in a culture where being restrictive with food intake is often praised and celebrated. And it's, you know, it's quite trendy to put on Instagram pictures of your green smoothies and this kind of clean eating sort of focus. But I've certainly seen a lot of people over the years for whom that has been really either an eating disorder in disguise as clean eating or as something that someone is defining as healthy. But we know that anything obsessive isn't healthy. One of the questions I often ask my clients when they're telling me that, oh, but I'm just eating healthy. And for example, we've seen a very significant increase in vegan diets. And there's always a question for health professionals working in the eating disorder field to try and identify whether the vegan diet is actually for spiritual reasons or for reasons that are working well for that individual person, or whether it's restrictive eating and an eating disorder in disguise. And when it comes along with other things like a preoccupation with weight and shape and an obsessiveness about body size and appearance and a rigidity and a lack of flexibility or spontaneity around food, then these are some of the other things that we might be considering that indicate things might be a little bit more problematic. I think it's really important for health professionals across the board to be really careful about the messages we give about health, because we need to remember that health is physical and psychological and spiritual and social and relational. You know, I'll often ask people if they tell me they're on a very restricted diet, if your friend who you haven't seen for a while phoned you up and said, would you like to come around to my house tonight and we're going to order pizza and it would be really nice to see you. And if a person says, well, I would say no to that because of the food that I would need to eat in that situation, then it's an opportunity to start to ask further questions to really check on that person's restrictive relationship with food. Of course, I'm not talking about people who have formally diagnosed food intolerances or food allergy issues. That's another story. But that's another challenge in the eating disorder field. There's a lot of people who are maybe self-diagnosing with food intolerances. And again, that can be a way to hide or masquerade these very restrictive eating behaviors. So I think the key thing about all of those, the self-diagnosis about food intolerances is, of course, as doctors would know, the importance of that being properly assessed. And also that if someone needs to be on a more restricted diet because of food intolerances, it's really important that they see a good dietitian who can help them make sure they're meeting their nutritional requirements adequately, even with those medical requirements for an altered food intake. So that's a long answer, sorry, but coming back to orthorexia, we live in a culture where there's this extreme fear of being in a larger body. And at the beginning of COVID-19, there was some research done from, I can't remember which university in America, and they asked a bunch of college students the classic would you rather question. So would you rather get COVID-19 or gain X amount of weight? And I can't remember what the amount was. It was a few kilograms. And the overwhelming majority of people in this group said they would rather get COVID-19, which I think is a terrifying example of the extreme fear about weight that we have in many areas of our society and this preoccupation with weight and shape. And I know there are some people who would be listening to me and saying the yes, but, you know, yes, but there is a concern, especially that's often voiced in the medical field about the health impacts of being in a larger body. But really, when that research is looked at more carefully, it's usually not weight in and of itself that is causing the health problems. It's behaviors, it's levels of activity, eating a variety of foods, drinking enough water, it's sleeping well, it's all the things that might contribute to how someone's body is feeling. But weight in and of itself, it's not really enough of a focus because there are some people who are perfectly healthy in a larger body. And that I think needs to be recognized, that we need to stop focusing on weight and instead focus on health-related behaviors. Otherwise, sometimes there's a big increase also in recognition of the incidence of atypical anorexia nervosa. And it basically means someone meets all the criteria for anorexia nervosa except the BMI criteria. So they've lost a large amount of weight, they're on extremely restrictive food intake, preoccupation with weight and shape, but they might be in a weight range that might be even in a higher weight range or might be a range that seems that's often thought of as healthy. But the problem is that sometimes people have started at a higher weight and then developed this extreme obsessive restrictive response to food and are actually malnourished even in higher weight bodies. So it just keeps reinforcing, I think, the issue that we need to focus on eating behaviors and people's relationship with their body as opposed to focusing on weight directly.
It's a really obviously important concept for us to be thinking about and talking about more. And I have an interest in mental health and psychiatry also from an aspect of really enjoying physical exercise and fitness as well. And having moved through some of those circles in terms of different pursuits within the fitness industry, I think part of orthorexia and why it's gradually become something that we are hearing more about, reading more about, maybe even thinking more about for ourselves is because it is something that is tied in quite a lot with some of the aspects to our culture socially right now, talking about things like diet culture, fitness industry, body image pressures within society. And so I think all of these things influence in part how we feel we might need to adjust our diets or our food and fluid intake from the orthorexia perspective. And so as you said, in a nutshell, when we're talking about orthorexia or orthorexia nervosa, we're talking about a restrictive or a disordered intake of food and fluids based on strict categories for foods that align with a pure good, in inverted commas, or otherwise idealized category of food. So this is often around people really, I think, initially wanting to approach their diets and things from an aspect of health. But when we talk about this concept of orthorexia, we're talking about that getting to a point where someone restricting or categorizing or blocking out certain food groups and things as being good and bad, clean and dirty, when that starts to reach a point where someone is having their physical health impacted on, so for example, their weight or their nutrition, and or it's impacting them mentally as well to a point where it's actually making them very anxious or depressed or impairing their ability to function at work, to socialize, or to lead their life how they ideally want to. That's when we start to talk about this concept of orthorexia. It's something that we're seeing more of. And to be honest, I think it is something that's been driven quite a bit by a lot of the pressures that are in our culture at the moment. So when it comes to advertising, social media, the online world, all of these pressures and messages and images we're being hit with to need to eat clean, be healthy, look a certain way. For guys, it might be getting jacked. For girls, all of those pressures are still around the ideal body shape and weight. All of that, I think, subtly interacts here with concepts of healthy eating and clean eating. And sometimes for people, that can reach a point where they are really caught up in that to a point of it impacting their lives and or their physical health. So that would be, I think, where this concept of orthorexia starts to get a bit closer to potentially being at least one day a diagnosable mental illness.
That's an interesting point you mentioned there, Janet, about how focusing on weight can be harmful and that we shouldn't be focusing only on weight but more on health behaviours. Tell us a bit more about that. It isn't something we hear much of in our training.
Yeah, I hear that feedback from doctors a lot, and I'm always really keen to talk to doctors about a model called Health at Every Size. And Health at Every Size approach is very much an approach that says that it's important that we really focus on the person and that individual person's health-related behaviors rather than focusing on weight as an indicator of health. Because especially for people who may be in larger bodies or at a higher weight, the medical recommendations are often about weight loss and dieting. But we know that weight loss dieting can actually be a very unhealthy focus and can be one of the main risk factors for the development of an eating disorder. There's a group of practitioners in Australia that I'm part of called Health at Every Size Australia, and it's a really important approach, I think, for doctors to be educated in how to have that health focus rather than looking at weight in and of itself as an indicator of health. Because we know that people can have different health outcomes at different places along the weight continuum, and not every body type or body is meant to be within a very narrow weight range that might be medically assumed to be healthy. So what's really important is that we're focusing on health-related behaviors. So we're focusing on people's relationship with food, the regularity of eating, whether they're moving for pleasure, whether they're having a kind of moderate relationship with food, as opposed to weight loss dieting, which we know is often extreme, usually doesn't work anyway in terms of long-term health outcomes, and can actually be really problematic and dangerous for people in the risk of developing an eating disorder.
It's a really tricky topic because obviously medically we know that in some instances for some people, weight in terms of excess adipose tissue or excess fat can have some very real potential impacts on someone's physical health and their mental health potentially as well. And obviously that is very, very much a sometimes. There is evidence out there that just because someone is a certain weight or might even be overweight from a point of adipose tissue, that is not to say that that person will always or necessarily have struggles or issues with their physical or their mental health. From a scientific and a medical side of things, we know, and obviously we learn in medical school, don't we, that some of those potential outcomes and impacts on health are very real. So there's that side of things, but then there is also the other side of things, as you point out, that when it comes to a focus and a fixation on weight and BMI, sometimes some of the messaging there that spins in this bit of a chicken and an egg scenario between medicine and culture, that can get a bit difficult and potentially damaging. To have people feeling that everything needs to be fixated purely on their weight or their BMI is not always helpful. And when we're thinking about some of the potential mental health impacts and outcomes for that, it's very much in line with talking about body image and eating disorder struggles. If there's too much focus on weight and BMI as a number in itself, without actually looking at how this person is actually doing physically and mentally in terms of their health, then that might actually set people up in a broad term and in a cultural way to feel this need for everything to be centered around how they look and what number is on the scale. But it is a really tricky argument, and obviously there are some quite heated, quite strong differing opinions on that as well. Online especially, there are some very strong views in communities around the anti-diet movement or diet culture. And then there is the other side of things in terms of maybe the more medical type arguments around there being a need for us to continue to know that that in some circumstances, excess weight and excess adipose tissue can have an impact on someone's health. So I think, as with most things in psychiatry and our culture and society, at least in my view, approaching this in a balanced way. And again, bringing in that term of sometimes, but not always. You know, it is important for us to be thinking about our diet, our nutritional intake, and at times, weight and adipose tissue. But it's not a hard and fast rule, obviously, as I'm sure everyone listening will know, to say that someone's health wholly and fully depends on a number on a scale or how much they weigh. And it's important that we recognize that too much of a focus on weight can impact body image, people's mental health, and feed into sometimes some of these restrictive, maybe more disordered types of eating behaviors and beliefs that can lead people to actually have more of a negative impact on their health than a benefit. So it's a pretty complex thing. And I think we could probably spend a whole podcast episode talking just about that. But I think as doctors and within medicine, it's important for us to be aware of both sides here. And that balance is probably what's needed. We need to be aware of some of the impacts that weight can have on someone's health. But we also need to be aware of some of the negative impacts that focusing too much on weight and body image can also have on someone's health, particularly on their mental health.
And those are some really important points that we should take note of. And thanks for your insight so far. But before we continue, we have a quick word from the MEL 2.0 team.
Hey, everyone. So to commemorate the convention that never was, MEL 2.0 is dropping exclusive merch on Sunday, August 2nd. We have a limited number of patches and t-shirts, so get in quick when sales open. We're also acknowledging AMSA's most seasoned veterans with coveted medals of honour based on the sticker book and eSports Day participation. For more information, head to the AMSA National Convention Facebook page.
Welcome back. We've been talking about what eating disorders are and what's important in caring for a patient or a client with an eating disorder. And we've also talked about how the preoccupation with weight and shape, including in the health field, can contribute to eating disorders and how this new word we've been hearing about, orthorexia, it ties in with that and with our culture's tendency to go to the extremes, like even in our personal health. I think we mentioned that eating disorders can be quite complex. So there are definitely many different health professionals involved in caring for people who have eating disorders. So maybe talk a bit about that and your experiences with that.
That's a key point to helping people move through eating disorders. It's always a very MDT and multidisciplinary approach when we're coming at these mental health struggles, because like we just touched on, it's something that's not just contained to the mental health world. It's something that has really significant potential outcomes, obviously, on someone's physical health as well. And that is part and parcel to most disorders of eating. Obviously, this depends on where someone is at on a spectrum of their struggles with weight and body image and eating in terms of severity, but also what type of eating disorder they're struggling with as well. But it's always a very multidisciplinary approach. So you'll have psychiatry team often involved. Psychologists are vital here in terms of working with people around their thoughts, feelings, and behaviors around food and how that relates to often their sense of self. There's a lot of complex psychology underlying struggles with eating, and that can be anything to do from identity, fear and anxiety, and a need to have some greater sense of control around the environment or yourself. And obviously, the big ticket item is often concerns around our self-worth when it comes to our body, our weight, our appearance, and that aspect. That's a key part to many eating disorders. And so psychologist involvement to be working with people around that and assisting them to, with time, slowly change their relationship with food is vital. obviously dietitians and nutritionists are a really vital part to this as well, and that is key. So these guys are a massive help, and obviously when I'm working with patients with struggles with eating and with body image, having the dietitians involved is always something that I'm so thankful for, because obviously they're the pros there in terms of working through with someone what exactly they're eating, what the calorie level is there, what the nutritional intake is there, and where we need to slowly progress to help increase someone's calorie intake if that's coming from a place of a restrictive eating disorder, but also to look at the balance of nutrition that they're taking in to ensure that, again, with time, we can be making sure that someone's nutrition is optimized. There may be a need for other specialties as well. Obviously, GPs and general medical doctors are often involved. And if it's supporting someone in a community setting with struggles with an eating disorder, GPs are really a pivotal part to that puzzle, because they need to be regularly checking someone's ECG, blood pressure, heart rate, temperature, electrolytes. Again, depending on the level of severity, it's really an important gauge of where someone is on their journey with recovery, with struggles with eating, to keep a regular eye on those physical parameters too. So GPs are often a vital part to this in the community and work closely with the mental health teams, with the psychologists, with the dietitians as well. It's definitely a team approach here, which is again why this is something that all of us need to keep in mind, regardless of what area of medicine we're going into. And even for our surgical mates or surgical people listening here as well, there may be times where surgeons are involved as well in terms of issues with the guts, the esophagus, the mouth and dentition. All these can be impacted in certain cases by severe eating disorders as well, whether it's from purging or other aspects of intake. So it really very much is a team affair, and that's all geared around getting the best outcome for the patient and to support someone who's struggling with their eating in all aspects of that, mentally, physically, nutritionally, and otherwise. It can be a challenge in terms of a lot of different aspects needing to come together and a lot of different teams needing to work together. But in my work, at least in the inpatient setting in the hospital, on the medical and surgical wards, it's often a really beautiful thing to see the multidisciplinary team really coming together and collaborating to make sure that a patient is acutely stabilized, but also then assisted with a plan to optimize things and get them on that road to recovery mentally and physically.
Yeah, so it's actually quite a significant team, and this can definitely be one of the challenges in the eating disorder field, especially in the private setting. So I work in a private practice clinic, and so as you can imagine, that gets quite expensive for people to have access to all of those different health professionals. So thankfully, that was why last year the federal government announced the eating disorder treatment plans, the initiative where doctors can approve and refer people for private practice care, where they can access Medicare rebates for up to 40 sessions with a psychologist in a year and up to 20 sessions with a dietitian. And that's been a huge benefit for so many people in accessing treatment for eating disorders, because a team approach is really important in working with the complexity of the eating disorder. And one of the things I really appreciate and enjoy when I work in a team with people when caring for people with eating disorders, I really enjoy that collaborative team approach. And we at our clinic have excellent relationships with a number of GPs and psychiatrists who we're really happy to be able to have regular case discussions, because often clients with eating disorders can be very complex. After 28 years as a health professional, I'm a big believer of the importance of health professionals supporting each other. I think the ability to phone each other up, for me to phone one of the doctors who's seeing one of my clients and to share our impressions of that person, to talk about their ongoing care, and really just to share a little bit about how it is to be working with a person who's often in so much distress, it's really important, and I think is a very significant self-care issue for health professionals. Something else that I'm also very passionate about is self-care for those of us who work with complex clients. And I actually supervise on a psychological level a number of doctors in that way as well, because I think doctors are not always good at focusing on their own mental health and don't always have this kind of model of supervision that we have in psychology. I think it's actually really important for doctors to have that too, to have someone you can go to and talk about the impact of the work on you as a person. I think that's another part of what's important about sharing with other health professionals in the team, is that when you're working with people with eating disorders, it's a condition with the highest mortality rate of any mental health condition and often with high rates of comorbidity. You know, these are very serious conditions where often there can be challenges in terms of people's motivation to change and willingness to address eating behaviors or weight concerns. So yeah, it's really important to be working together. I guess the other thing I might just mention here while I'm thinking about self-care and doctors is that there is actually also some research that shows a fairly high incidence in weight concern, preoccupation with weight and shape, and also eating disorders amongst medical students. And over the years, I've seen many, many medical students as clients, some of whom have a diagnosed eating disorder and some are along the continuum of disordered eating. And I think there can be a lot of pressure that doctors put on themselves, especially young doctors and trainee doctors, to be this kind of pillar of health. We've just got to watch this issue of balance because probably, as we all know, I'm making huge generalizations here and I hope this is not offensive, but we also know that people who do medical training are usually incredibly intelligent, highly perfectionistic, have very high self-expectations and standards for achievement. And those are some of the things where sometimes people can do with a little bit of psychological support to help keep things in moderation and in balance. And if I think about one thing that after all these years working in the eating disorder field, one thing that I wish there was a way that we could put it through our water supply so everybody gets a dose of it would be the ability to be moderate. Because I think as a culture, generally speaking, we lack moderation. And most of the food issues in our culture are about a lack of moderation. We see the extremes in so many regards, you know, the extreme of that healthism, as we were talking about before with orthorexia. Or we see the other extreme of people who are maybe, you know, not focused on taking care of their bodies through food and activity. And if we could help everyone be more moderate, including us health professionals, that would go a long way towards contributing to the well-being of our communities.
And that's definitely something for our listeners to think about there in terms of how work can affect us and how we can support each other in this. We know that eating disorders have a lot to do with our culture's focuses, and we've talked about how our culture seems to lack moderation. So what can we do to shape the conversation around body image and eating disorders, like as individuals and for our listeners, as students and also as future doctors?
I think that's a fantastic question for doctors to consider. And I think one of the big changes that's really important is for our medical system to be focused on exactly that, on helping people learn to be more moderate in their relationship with food and activity. And that's really important. I mentioned earlier about this health at every size approach, which is all about health-related behavior. And I think there are a number of great questions that doctors can be asking people in the consulting room or in the clinics that they're working in that can just help to see the impact. I'm thinking of someone in particular who I've been working with who went to her doctor and she's lost a very large amount of weight in a very short period of time. And unfortunately, the response that she had from the doctor was just fantastic. Congratulations, keep going. But the client came to me and told me how she'd achieved that weight loss and the consequences of that weight loss and the eating behaviors on her life. And I'm saying, you need to stop. This is very dangerous. So I think it's really important that all of us, all health professionals, we stop focusing on weight as a parameter of wellness. And instead, when someone has lost weight, asking, how did you go about that? And what kind of behaviors are you doing? And are you still eating regularly, to try and get a sense of the behaviors that have led to that change in body size, as opposed to just celebrating weight loss, because our culture tends to do that. And health professionals can be some of the biggest perpetrators of that, I think. And also, I think in terms of body image, it's also fair to assume that most people, especially young people, have a complicated body image because we grow up in a world that tells us to be dissatisfied with our bodies from childhood. So it's pretty common to not have a healthy relationship with body image, unfortunately. But what's important, I think, again, I keep saying this, but to help focus on health-related behaviors and how we can feel stronger or more capable or more at ease and relaxed in our bodies, as opposed to always focusing on appearance or size or shape. I have so many clients I can think of over the years for whom I can say, if weight loss were the cure for poor body image, then most of the people I see, I wouldn't be seeing. That in reality, if the assumption is weight loss will make me happy, that's an incorrect assumption. Being more healthy, yeah, sure, that can make me happier. If I go out for a walk in the morning and I eat breakfast and focus on more moderate behaviors, sure, that can contribute to my mental health. But weight loss in and of itself doesn't do that. And one more thing I'd say is really important for doctors not to do, which is to not give clients diets. Weight loss dieting, it doesn't work in the long term anyway. When people go on excessive diets, as soon as they stop the diet, they have a weight rebound. And there's so much research that shows that. But also the other issue is that weight loss dieting is one of the key risk factors for the development of an eating disorder. So I think it's really important that when doctors are working with clients who have, or patients who have complex issues going on with food, or who might be confused about food because they've read one magazine article says you should never have dairy and the next one says you should eat all the dairy. And what's really important, I think, is that doctors refer to dietitians. A good dietitian is able to spend time really assessing and individualizing the recommendations for that person and recognizing that there is no one size fits all to nutrition, and that individualized, more therapeutic approach is really important. I hear examples sometimes of doctors just handing out weight loss diets to their patients, and I'd really recommend that people not do that.
Yeah, I really like that question. And it is something that I'm passionate about, obviously with mental health as a whole, but talking about these things in the media and on social media, I think it's important that we start to demystify them a little bit. And as with every area of psychiatry and mental health, it's to think about calling out a lot of the stigma around some of these things as well. I think when it comes to us as doctors, medical students, and then just as people and individuals, I think the first step is always around calling this stuff out as nothing to be stigmatized or ashamed of or guilty about in any way. And when it comes to body image struggles in particular, this is something that research shows we all struggle with at some point in some way, and that's for men and women. So something that I'm quite interested in and I talk a lot about online and when I have media gigs and things is that, you know, when it comes to men's mental health in particular, things with body image and weight and appearance pressures are actually creeping in more and more. Again, around those societal, advertising, social media type pressures. For men and women, this is something that we really need to be thinking about and calling out more, because it's something that a significant amount of people are struggling with. We know that across a woman's life, she will have an incredible amount of explicit and implicit messages and pressures thrown at her in terms of what she needs to look like, weigh, eat, to be ideal or worthy or within society. And what we're seeing is that for men, that is creeping in more and more too. So in a slightly different way, obviously, young men and boys are now being sent messages subtly, more and more regularly, around what they need to look like, weigh, how much muscle they need to have compared to fat, what their biceps need to look like and their abs, for them to feel that they have a sense of self-worth and a real place in society. These are some powerful, often implicit things that we're getting messaged about every single day, even when we just flip on Instagram. So I think it really is about starting that conversation and knowing that this is something that doesn't have to be at a disordered level or diagnosed as an eating disorder or a body image disorder to be potentially a part of someone's health and their mental health. And so I think as medical students and as doctors, but also just as individuals, it's cluing in a bit more for ourselves about where we're at with that, but also not being afraid to talk about it with others, whether that's with family or mates, to normalize some of these things. Because particularly when it comes to body image struggles and eating struggles, these conditions really feed off shame and guilt and secrecy. So I think one of my big parts to all this in terms of sharing some more of this information, whether it's in the fitness type world or the medical mental health type world, it's about just calling some of these things out and getting the information out there. I think as medical students and doctors, the more we can be asking our patients about these things, talking about these things, and letting people know that it's very, very common and it's okay to be struggling with it. I think that's the best way that we can be moving forward with this stuff in whatever realm it's in, whether it's in the fitness world, the Instagram world, the medical world. We need to start ripping the lid off this thing and taking away some of the stigma and the shame around it.
Those are some really interesting points about how we can change things, like not only the way we interact with our patients around issues like weight, but also just taking away the stigma around these issues in our conversations, both as healthcare professionals and just as people. I'm afraid that's almost all the time we have. So in closing, maybe just tell us what advice you would give yourself at the start of your career.
I would have given myself so many different points of advice, I think. Maybe if I can think of one point of advice in terms of what we have been talking about, it would be to soak up and take in aspects of all the different areas of medicine that you're studying, that you're getting experience in, that you're doing your clinical rotation in, and knowing that in some way, regardless of what specialty you go into, you're going to use bits and pieces of that for the good of your patient. For my work now as a hopefully a soon-to-be psychiatrist, there are aspects to my studies and my rotations and then my work as an intern and things in my early career that I still use and come into every single day. And just like we've talked about here with eating disorders, that might be looking at an ECG or aspects of something that I learned on plastic surgery on the burns unit in terms of how injuries can affect someone's cognition and mental health. So I think a piece of advice for me would be to just remember that whatever area of medicine you are thinking of moving into, or for those of us in medical school that knew from day dot that they wanted to be an ENT surgeon, for example, I think it's still keeping in mind that even if you're going to be a sub-specialist ENT surgeon, you are still going to be coming into contact with patients every single day who have struggles and aspects to their care that is mental health, palliative care, general medicine. And it's knowing that, yes, as doctors, we get funneled down into these specialist routes. But really, when you break it down, we're all still dabbling in each other's work a little bit and coming into contact with patients who are never just one condition or one subspecialty in isolation. So I think for me, the advice would be to not just get through my other runs because I knew that I wanted to be a psychiatrist. It would be to know that every single run that you do and every little piece of info you learn will come in handy for whatever specialist you end up being or whatever area of medicine you move into.
So at around the age of 30, I very significantly burned out and left the profession of psychology for a couple of years. I ran away to India and became a yoga teacher and said I would never be a psychologist again because I was so burned out and jaded. And actually, that was the best experience that could have happened, even though it was really tough at the time. But what I learned at that time was that I have to look after myself, that I am the tool of my trade, you know, so my health and well-being, my mental health, my physical health, this is it, you know. I don't drive a truck that I need to get serviced. It's like, this is it, my physical and emotional and mental and spiritual self. So, you know, thankfully through running away to India and studying yoga, I've developed a whole system of self-care. So I have my own yoga practice. I meditate regularly. I do all of those kinds of things. I actually don't know how I would still be 28 years down the track as a psychologist without some kind of self-care system like that. So I don't know. I think about, would I have wanted to give myself that advice at the start of my career? It might have been nice advice, but you know what? I learned the hard way because I think I needed to do that. And so I actually would really encourage everybody to really prioritize your self-care. There's always too much work. You know, there's never enough time and there's always too much work. So if we wait until we have time to do our meditation or to go for a walk or to visit our friends, if we wait for some mysterious free time, then we might never do it. So the importance of self-care, I think, is something I can't stress enough. Self-care and support, you know, don't be alone. Like this work is hard. Being a health professional is hard work. And we really need to support each other and look after each other. So, yeah, self-care and support, I guess, are my two big messages.
Amazing. Thanks so much for being with us today.
No worries. Thanks so much for having me, mate. It's a pleasure. And yeah, like we said, this is really important stuff. And in terms of talking more about mental health, but just knowing the important place that body image and eating disorders can have in all areas of medicine, like we've talked about, it's really important. So yeah, thanks for having me on.
And, you know, I really wish everyone well who's listening to this podcast. I think that we need, the world needs good doctors, right? So I think what you're all doing is fantastic. And I wish you well, all of you, for your future careers.
Whoa, okay. I don't know what happened there. But anyway, thanks for listening to today's episode of the AMSA Ampio Podcast's MEL 2.0 series. Our code word this week is lab of the map. And if you go to our website at www.m2020.com.au and insert the code word in our portal, you go into the running for some great prizes and giveaways. And over the course of our series, you'll be able to collect an image per week for our MEL 2.0 sticker book. The MEL 2.0 series is a subset of AMPIO, the Australian Medical Students Association's ongoing podcast series, to highlight speakers who would have presented at our 2020 AMSA National Convention. If you would like to learn more about our podcast, you can visit our website at www.m2020.com.au or our parent website, www.amsa.org.au. Or if you prefer, we are on social media as @AMSAConvention on Facebook and Instagram. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not definitively represent those of AMSA or their subsidiaries. If you would like to know more about our public policies, please visit our website at www.amsa.org.au and select Advocacy followed by Official Policy. This episode of AMPIO was hosted and edited by Daryl Goh, with guests Janet Lowndes and Kieran Kennedy, music by James Pomier, and credits by Nick Barrett. Thanks for listening. Thank you.